Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight's topic is the JonBenet Ramsey case. I am Kim Colton, Director of Research for CrimeWire, and I'll be manning the switchboard and monitoring the chat room. And now, let me introduce the host of tonight's show, statement analyst and CrimeWire consultant, Peter Hyatt. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. And, you know, what I want to do is, let's see if I even have it right here. Yes, I do. I want to tell our listeners that we really would like them to call in with any questions, that anything they would like to know about this case. And the number to call is 646-478-0982. That way, Peter, I think we get a better grip on what people are really interested in about this case. What do they want to know?
Yeah, and I think this is a case that really highlights just how sensitive statement analysis can be and what an incredibly accurate and precise tool it can be. I know that people have been leaving questions at the blog, and as the chat room fills up, people will ask questions there. But it's enjoyable to take the questions live. It's a lot of fun, and I think it's a great spice to the program.
It is. It is a lot of fun. And to tell you the truth, when I'm monitoring the chat room, the questions whiz by so fast, I don't have a chance to write them down. So. Calling in is always a great thing. Again, that number is 646-478-0982. We would like to hear from you. Peter, can you give our listeners an overview of the JonBenet Ramsey case?
Sure. And then I'd like to touch on these five questions that I put out for
readership. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. As I look back, just around Christmas of 1996, we learned of the murder of a little girl, 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey. And I, myself, my family, others who knew the case, I think many of us have gone through a roller coaster of emotions, of thoughts, of debating whodunit, that sort of thing. And I've noticed that a lot of people have come to very strong opinions where they defended them emotionally and with great vigor, and then abandoned the opinions and changed their opinions over time. And I can't help but wonder if some of the behavioral analysis that we've done, some of the cases where a child has gone missing and the parents did not cooperate with police, if that has impacted their thinking over time. And I also think that the Ramseys' wealth and their affluence, their religious stance, that these sort of things don't happen to upper class or upper middle class type people like that, good Christian people, that this couldn't happen there. And that took some time to erode away.
It did. That did take time. And it was hard 96 in any time, any year actually, but it was hard to think that no, the parents couldn't have done this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, in early 97, and this would be really the first 2 weeks of the case, I think that the Ramseys as parents really took a heavy hit in public opinion, because what people saw was a family hiding behind lawyers, a family not cooperating with police. Police had gone out early and said, hey, everyone, there's no reason to be afraid at night. There's not some secret killer out there. And the sides were drawn very quickly. One of the things that I think is fascinating because it appeals to common sense, is behavioral analysis. It sounds more complicated than it is. Basically, we ask people, what would you do if you were in a certain situation? And we find that people react in a common sense way. Kim, we covered this with missing children. If your
right.
child was in Walmart and your child wandered off, the first thing you would do is call out your child's name. And so when a child goes missing and a parent does not call out the child's name, we say something is very, very wrong in that case. And indeed, it is. But this is how accurate behavioral analysis can be. If your child was murdered, the first thing we would do is turn to the police for answers and for help and for to do anything that we could do. And the polygraph becomes the big dividing point. People that, say in a missing child case, John Walsh has, the father of Adam Walsh, he has advised families, for instance, that when your child goes missing, those first 48 hours are critical. So cooperate with the police, clear yourself, demand to take a polygraph. Don't wait to be asked. Demand to take a polygraph immediately so they can clear you and move on and find that child. And so that's a really simple type of reaction. In the case of the Ramseys, we didn't see the cooperation with police, not from the get-go and not after they had lawyers and not ever since. They have always stonewalled police, and the reason being that we say is that when someone is deceptive, they have a need to be deceptive or a reason to be deceptive. When someone is uncooperative, they have a reason to be uncooperative. So even as I've gone through various emotional viewpoints of the case, what's come down to is the initial reaction that many of us had. I think it was December 26th, it hit the news, the 27th of 1996, where we saw images of a little six-year-old girl dressed up in a very provocative, shocking, inappropriate manner. I know that we've shifted culturally since that time. I know that you know, we're the honey boo-boo or whatever that is generation
right.
now.
Right.
But most parents in 1996, 1997, that period of time, were shocked at the sexualization of this little child.
Mm-hmm.
And where a child is sexualized, we often find sexual abuse. So if we were to wipe the slate clean and say, well, you know, let's just talk about this case. Let's pretend we don't know much about it, and we'll just kind of talk it through.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we saw was a picture, all these pictures of outrageous Las Vegas showgirl type of costumes,
mm-hmm.
bleached hair and cap teeth on a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked sexualized. When I first saw this on the news, I was sitting next to my own little girl who was the same age and who had a similar appearance to JonBenet, blonde hair, pretty little girl, who loved to wear dresses. She was all girl. She loved the gender distinction. And she probably at that point had hardly ever wore pants. She just loved her dresses and her skirts and always was a dress-up, but never sexualized, never in a manner that made her appear like she was older.
Like she was a Vegas showgirl.
Right. And it was never like that.
Mm-hmm.
So my first reaction was, oh my, who in the world would dress their child like that? This is highly inappropriate. I hope she wasn't sexually abused. My initial thoughts. Then I introduced the subject of sexual abuse. And then I heard that the family was wealthy. And right away my mind goes to, people with money don't do that sort of thing. And of course the people with money do, but we all have different types of prejudices that we have to shed off over time. And it's not just those that are impoverished that have these type of issues going on. It's all sectors, but we just don't expect it in the upper class that way. Then we learned that she had chronic urinary tract infections. So dressing like a Las Vegas showgirl, sexualizing appearance, doesn't mean that she was sexually abused, but it certainly is concerning. Second thing is that she had chronic urinary tract infections. 7 years of investigating child abuse having interviewed probably more than 2,500 mothers, fathers, and children, has taught me that when there are a lot of urinary tract infections, doctors, social workers, teachers, investigators are concerned about the possibility of sexual abuse. Then we have the bedwetting, the chronic bedwetting. Bedwetting in and of itself is not necessarily something that proves anything other than she's wetting the bed. However, children that are sexually molested often have a problem with bedwetting. So there was in the very early days, there were three indications that there was sexual abuse possibility in the life of JonBenet Ramsey. It wasn't until later on in life where I studied statement analysis, and specifically under Avinon Sapir, he immigrated from Israel to America, I believe in the late 70s, and he is the grandfather of all statement analysis. All across this country, the FBI, the CIA, the other various levels of intelligence that we have in our country, they are all in debt to his teaching, no matter what name it's tagged under, whether it's discourse analysis or the Reed technique or under a lot of different names and taught well under different ways. He is the grandfather. He is the guy who put that together in a marvelous way. And interesting enough, in the language of John Ramsey, are indicators of sexual abuse. We know that out of parents that sexually abuse their children, it is very likely that that parent was sexually abused in childhood. Not everyone, most people that are sexually abused do not go on to offend others. But of those that do offend, they are very likely to have been sexually abused in childhood themselves. Interesting enough, this slips into the language. And there are indicators of people that have been sexually abused in one form or another that leaks out in their language. And as coincidence may have it, this happened to me very recently in an interview where I was interviewing someone about something that happened, and she said, "I opened the door and I found such and such there." Now, I paused as I heard that, and there really is no reason for the person to tell me that they first opened the door before they found what they were looking for. It is something that, percentage-wise, falls into the language of those who have suffered sexual abuse. And as I commented on that, I received immediate verification that it was true. So, it's a fascinating thing, and Mr. Sapir is the one to be credited with that.
Did you see any of that in the ransom note? Or was it in Mr. Ramsey's statements?
Yep. It was actually when he was describing what happened, and really that's the best question is to ask what happened. But I just want to touch on that before I move on. When you go to sleep tonight, you might say, 10 o'clock I went to sleep, or 10 o'clock I went to bed. Someone else might say, I turned off the lights and went to sleep. And it's really unnecessary for them to tell me that they turned off the lights. Someone else might say, I went to my bedroom, I closed the door, I turned off the lights and went to sleep. All of it is very unnecessary. Most people simply report what they did. It's the additional references that give us an amazing amount of information. So when people mention lights, it is often in their minds sexuality is at play. We find this in abused children. Abused children will say, I closed the door and I went to sleep. Or they might become very nervous when they talk about doors opening, for instance. Or they might become relieved when they talk about a door closing in a child interview, where you might think to yourself, why is the child even mentioning the door opening or closing or the lights going on and off, when really it was just someone would just say, I went to bed or went to sleep. I got in bed and I went to sleep, that sort of thing. So what we have found through careful study over many, many years is that when doors opening and closing in unnecessary situations and lights coming into the language, there's often an indication of sexuality, in particular sexual abuse, in play. And so we listen to this carefully, we flag it, we try to make notice of it, and we listen for it carefully. John Ramsey was asked what happened. And in his description, he doesn't say that he found her when he went looking for the body. I guess we'll back up a little bit for the people's sake that may not know the case. They had found a ransom note, 5-something that morning, very early in the morning, and called the police. I'll get to the 911 call. And were waiting around for hours for the kidnappers on the ransom note to call. And when they didn't, the police officer that was present was getting nervous and kept watching John Ramsey, so she wanted to give him something to do. She said, "Why don't you go search the house again?" And he went, and as I would say, he found the body in the basement. When he was asked to describe that, he didn't say, "I found my daughter in the basement," or "I found her body in the basement." He said, "I opened the door, and there she was. I opened the door, and there she was." And these are really unnecessary words for anyone to speak. And so we listen to them carefully, and we wonder why someone would need to tell us, first they opened the door. Well, people generally don't like to lie. It causes internal stress. So what they'll do is they'll say a lot of different things to avoid lying, but yet they aren't being deceptive. And so for John Ramsey to make that reference, another reference of Patsy Ramsey, where if someone is able to refer to themselves growing up, if I say, "When I was a 7-year-old boy, I played baseball. When I was a 7-year-old kid, I played baseball," that sort of thing. When someone refers to themselves as a child, when talking about growing up, it is often an indication that they were victims of child abuse, 80% likely to be child sexual abuse. And so these are the things that creep into our language. We don't say kid molesters, we say child molesters.
Mm-hmm.
We don't say boy abuse, we say child abuse. Or we don't say kid abuse, we say child abuse. So the word child is often associated with risk or abuse, where kid or boy is less tense or less nervous. So when I was a little boy, I did such and such. When I was a little girl, I went to dance class. Someone else might say, "When I was a child, I went to dance class." And then in an interview, I would say, "Were you a victim of child abuse growing up?" Perhaps later on in the interview. And time after time after time, the person would verify that they had been a victim of abuse. So it's just part of the language that creeps in. And so listening to that John Ramsey, we have a child who was dressed in a very sexualized way, and then we have B, the urinary tract infections, and we have C, the bedwetting, and then we have D, indications within the language of the parents that sexual abuse was something mm-hmm. on their minds. Now,
Peter, I just want to interrupt. One of our guests in the chat room, Hobnob, she said, "We have to listen only to the words they use rather than what we think they meant." And that is so true. It's like a listening skill.
One of the great principles goes on to say,
often it can be a single word that reveals the truth.
Yes. And this is why we don't interpret. We listen mm-hmm. to what someone tells us.
Mm-hmm.
When we interpret, we're actually making a mistake.
Yeah, because we're injecting our own thoughts, I think, anyway.
No, you're exactly right. We're actually projecting ourselves. And this is why I had a hard time in the beginning with accepting that JonBenet was murdered inside that home and that her parents were responsible for both her death, which I think was inadvertent, I'll get to, and the cover-up, which was deliberate. I had a difficult time because there were certain things that I could relate very much to. These were not scary-looking people. They were not. They didn't look like the child molester that you saw on television, that sort of thing. They appeared to be churchgoers, which really, over the years, I've come to understand that not simply good people go to church, but also those that are seeking to cover a guilty conscience have that need to cleanse. And so that really can't be anything one way or another. And coming to accept, especially through the language, that this is what that girl suffered, and it was awful. I do think, and this will be something for listeners to debate a little bit on themselves, I don't think that she died deliberately. I think that was probably an accidental, inadvertent death. Someone lost their temper.
But why? This is, yes, I agree. But why do the whole garrote thing, the positioning? That just freaks me out. I
think the answer actually comes from the Ramses themselves. Their interest, their vocabulary, the things that, about them really had to do with they read on true crime. It was a topic that was interesting to them. The ransom note has quotes from movies, Don't Grow a Brain, John, that sort of thing. The ransom note itself is so long. The ransom note, of course, it's statement analysis. Mark McClish did a good job with that. It's obviously a deceptive note. It was meant to throw people off. Well, so was the staging of the crime scene. They had said to have read John Douglas's works, The Mindhunter, one of his early works. There was a sophistication about the ransom note, and there was a sophistication about the crime scene that matches. I make a joke sometimes on the blog. I say, and hence, the words and hence are fine to use, but not together. Together, they're redundant. It's either hence, something happened, or something happened.
Right.
So it's very rare that anyone would say, and hence, like that. It's extremely rare, in fact. I don't know anyone that speaks that way, and I've never heard it before, and I've not found research that's found it. Interesting enough, it's in the ransom note, and hence, and it was found, and hence, it was found on a Christmas card that the Ramses sent to their church regarding the birth of Christ. So it was one of the things that just jumped out at people and said, wow, nobody uses that expression because it's not even proper English, and here we have it twice from the same family. The length of the ransom note makes it, as Mr. Sapir calls, the homogilla, the emotions and everything else that show the woman's writing, intimate knowledge of her husband's Christmas bonus or yearly bonus, that sort of thing. The emotions within it, the length of time it would take to write that type of note. If someone is kidnapping a child and they broke into that home, they are going to write one or two or lines and get the heck out of there really quick. What they're not going to do is literally sit down and write this long, lengthy letter, several-page letter, and then cross it out and start all over again and write another one. And within the ransom note are references to books and movies that the Ramses themselves either had in their home or were familiar with. So can we have an exercise that we use for investigators? What we do is we ask someone to tell a story. Either the story has to be 100% true or 100% lie, and everyone listening will have to decide whether it's true or it's lie, a deceptive lie. And people are easily deceived by tears or by emotions, but if you listen to the language, people will reveal to you whether it came from experiential memory or they're making it up. Even when they make something up, it often comes from movies or books or stories they've heard. It's really hard to invent something out of thin air. Just ask Casey Anthony. Her language revealed that at times when she was referring to things, though she was lying, there was always an element somewhere in her life about it.
Right.
And that's why people laughed about the Xanax and her making jokes about Xanax and then the Xanny and that sort of thing. There's always a genesis of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Or she rented a movie that had something similar. Billie Jean Dunn, she, as Nancy Grace recently said, Haley Dunn, the 13-year-old that was reported missing, never made it out of that home alive. That's not debated by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But when Billie Jean Dunn called into the Nancy Grace show to appear on the show, she gave a story of her daughter going over to a sleepover and having never made it.
Mm-hmm.
She got that from Nancy Grace's True Crime Library. So even, and this is for all of us, even when we're lying and making things up, we're getting our words from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was with the ransom note, with the Ramseys. They had to get their information from someplace, and it came from books in their home, and it came from movies they had seen. I can't remember one of the movies because it wasn't one of the ones that Bruce Willis movie, one of the Kill 'Em Hard or Die Hard type of movies.
Oh, Die Hard, yeah.
Yeah,
That's partly of what one of our chatters, Hobnob, is saying, is I wonder what reading material they had in their house or what programs they watched that would give them an idea for a foreign faction. And she says Die Hard, and it is. It's very, and that was a very popular movie. Could have been, it was, I'm sure, watched by millions, but.
Sure.
Definitely.
Interesting enough with the movies and things that came from their home, this is where I believe they learned to make the crime scene look as sophisticated as they possibly could. By the way, a small foreign faction, note to Patsy Ramsey, foreigners aren't foreigners to themselves. They're foreigners to us. People don't call themselves foreigners. They don't refer to themselves as foreigners. They feel that we're the foreigners.
Mm-hmm. Oh, true, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, little miss there for them. But also, I'd like to talk a little bit about the 911 call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's.
Talk about also the what their denials look like, what they here's an interesting thing for parents, and some of the listeners understand this. I say that a father can't molest his daughter. It's impossible for a father to molest his own daughter. And you say, that's ridiculous, Peter. We know that it happens all the time. And what I am referring to is not reality, but verbalized reality, linguistics. It's impossible for a father to molest his own daughter. What he must do is he must go through a process in his mind where he changes her. And I gave an example recently where a man said that his wife had gone to the store. His wife and daughter were home. His wife went to the store, and the girl had homework, and something must have happened. And then when the wife came home, he said, my daughter was crying. And while the wife was in the home, he could refer to her as my daughter and daughter. When his wife was gone and she was being sexually molested, he called her the girl. He had to go through a process in his mind.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it shows in the language. So where there's a change in language, and this is for all of us. I had someone once say to me, or about me, a young woman said a number of years ago, Peter's a good person. And then she met Heather, my wife. I'm sorry, she said, Peter's a good man. I like to work with him. So Peter's a good man. After meeting Heather, she said, Peter's a good person. And I asked her about it. I said, what changed me from being a man to
a person? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was the presence of Heather. She met Heather, and I was no longer
a man. You were
a man.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You were a person.
Right. Well, that's
she saw a little bit of you through Heather's eyes.
Exactly. And being a good person herself, that's not something that she would pursue on.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at, and this is really something, readers have seen this in some of the missing child cases, is a person will refer to their daughter and they'll refer to the child by name. They'll refer to the child in the pronoun her. And we found cases where, the baby Lisa case, Deborah Bradley could not bring herself to use Lisa's name. It was just so rare. Out of maybe 30 or 40 times where she referred to her, it was always a pronoun, and sometimes even the distancing language is that girl.
Yeah.
We saw this in the Billie Jean Dunn case of Haley, where Sean Atkins, the boyfriend, he said, "I would never have done anything to that girl."
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't bring himself to say that he didn't do anything, only
that,
he
girl.
Wouldn't.
That girl.
Yeah, that girl is distancing language.
Right.
He needed to distance himself from her.
Yeah.
And so this is something that we listen for very carefully, especially in family relationships. It gives us a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. And that's why in these series of broadcasts, Peter, that we will be doing, we will be bringing up a lot about Ayla Reynolds and Haley Dunn and Isabel Celis and Lisa Irwin, because it shows to you the impact of the JonBenet Ramsey case in each of these current high-profile cases. And I'm so glad we're going to be doing this series.
I think it really does. And I think it also helps people to understand that as parents, we, and you and I have talked about this before, we deal with the expected and the unexpected. There is an expected, we expect someone to act a certain way, and there is the unexpected, where we say, wow, we weren't thinking that. So when the child was at Walmart with the parent and the child wandered off, we expected the parent to call the child's name. The unexpected is the parent would get in the car and drive home and pretend that the child didn't exist. That would be terribly unexpected. In analysis, we're always dealing with the unexpected. We set up the expected, and we deal with the unexpected. So I asked people, and these were the five questions. In 1997, this would be probably January of 1997, what do you think happened to JonBenet? In January of 2013, what do you think happened to JonBenet? In 1997, who do you think wrote the ransom note? And in 2013, who do you think wrote the ransom note? And then going by this case and this case only, how has statement analysis impacted your opinion? And it's interesting that a lot of people have said, well, some of them flip back and forth between, I thought mother did it, I thought father did it, and I've changed my opinion of that, where it's been difficult to know. I thought that more people were persuaded by Lou Smith, for instance. Lou Smith was an investigator that was brought on for one purpose. The district attorney did not want to arrest the Ramseys. And he went out and he fought the police, and he went out and got his own investigator who admittedly prayed with the Ramseys and who worked fervently to clear them. And, of course, that's not his job, but that was what he was, it was paid to do. Nancy Grace had interviewed some private investigators for the Ramseys and who were saying that we've been pro bono for the Ramseys since 1999. And she actually caught them by using statement analysis that they had been paid previously because they'd been on board since 1996, where they actually admitted they were brought on by the Ramsey attorney, Lynn Wood, for the purpose of proving the intruder theory. And that's how hard someone would have to work to try to prove that an intruder did this. And we have to accept the ridiculous. We have to accept that someone came in and sat down for a long period of time, unafraid, with decent handwriting, of being caught, changing their mind, using the implements that are in the home, done this brutal murder without anyone hearing anything going on. It's just utterly ridiculous, and it's not what happened. What we don't know is actually how she died. That's been something that's been disputed back and forth. She appears to have died from blunt trauma to the head. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what I don't mean to say is that we don't know how she died. We don't know by whose hand she died. She died by blunt force trauma to the head, not by the slow strangulation. That was clearly a cover-up that was done. There's enough evidence in the autopsy to say that she was also sexually abused, and there was concerns about that. Part of that may have been part of the cover-up. But one of the things that we look at is that night, we know that the next morning, Patsy Ramsey got up, or actually she didn't say that she went to sleep. She came down the stairs. She was still wearing the same clothes that she had worn the night before.
Oh, that was a little odd.
Well, a lot odd, especially given who it was. Here's a former beauty pageant who has enough vanity for all of us put together, who is not likely going to be traveling anywhere on a plane to visit anyone wearing the same clothes she wore the night before.
Right.
She had she gave the timeline, and this is where the detectives found that she was tripped up. She gave the timeline where she had put JonBenet to bed, and what she didn't realize is that the autopsy showed that there was undigested pineapple in her stomach, meaning that the pineapple had been there somewhere about 2 hours before death only.
Mm-hmm.
And is it really likely that a six-year-old was able to get up in the middle of the night and get herself some pineapple, or worse, a kidnapper went to the refrigerator and gave her pineapple mm-hmm. before he killed her? That's also very goofy.
It is goofy. You're so right.
But what do we make of the fact that the first instinct of this family was to go to war with the police? When I taught interviewing, every person that conducts an interview gets a feeling that the interviewee or the subject is either working with me to bring out as much information as possible, or the person is working against me, like a chess match, trying to keep information from me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a feeling that everyone gets. Journalists get it. People that are in human resources that are interviewing for employment get it, that someone is really just trying to be as helpful as possible and give as much information as possible, or they're reluctant to do so and they're not being forthcoming and they're not being helpful and it's very hard to determine what's going on, that sort of thing. Well, we have an expectation that when that a parent would want their child's killer to be caught. And so
right.
They clear themselves immediately with interviews. They would take polygraphs. And when someone refuses, they have a reason to refuse. But even that, the behavioral analysis that we've gone through before on the Ramseys, even that is something that it just speaks to guilt. It doesn't speak to innocence. What bothers me is the behavior of Alex Hunter, the district attorney. And this is where it really begins to grate on people. The district attorney and relies on little district attorneys or assistant district attorneys who, for whatever reason, have not gone into private practice. Some may have stayed in the district attorney's office because they love catching the bad guy, whereas many others will leave that type of service, state service, because the money in the private practice is so much greater. And
mm-hmm.
generally speaking, money draws talent. Money will be a magnet for talent, and it will pull talent out of a system that doesn't pay very well. So if you put yourself in Alex Hunter's shoes,
mm-hmm.
the Ramseys are, they've got money. They have money, and they can afford any attorney. They grab on to the likes of Lynn Wood, who has a very serious reputation as being a very high-priced, difficult attorney. Alex Hunter gave every indication early on that he was scared to death of having to go up against him and his team, Lynn Wood and the Ramsey team, which included hiring anybody across the country. Because we have children murdered on a regular basis in our country, because they came for money and because of the sexualization and the pictures that went across the screen, this captured our nation's attention. Alex Hunter was not going to allow himself to be humiliated in a courtroom by these superior attorneys with the whole nation watching. And
mm-hmm.
so he did what cowardly prosecutors do. He attacked the police. And he began to leak information out to the National Enquirer and to the media. He literally sabotaged their case. He publicly humiliated the police, and we saw that it had a tremendous fallout where people were Steve Thomas quitting and others resigning, and it was just a terrible humiliation and embarrassment. But what we must do then is put ourselves in the shoes of the police who had dedicated their lives to justice for this child, worked day and night, leaving their families, not being paid in many cases overtime for it, not having good compensation, did everything that they could do as the case progressed, and of course no one's perfect, came to be able to prove that this little girl was murdered inside her house and no one got into that house and spent all the time doing what was done, and that it came down to the parents, that the parents have been uncooperative, the parents have refused polygraphs, the parents have refused to be interviewed separately, that they've done everything they can to make this as difficult on the police as possible by using high-priced lawyers. So Alex Hunter turned on them, and they had
mm-hmm.
done all this work, and he publicly humiliated them. And this is kind of an age-old thing that happens in our judicial system, is where a prosecutor does not feel he can win a case, he might simply say, I don't see it as winnable now, or he may try to save his own reputation by attacking the police. Sometimes police don't do a good job. I think for the most part, the police did do a good job. And so he brought in people deliberately who would be able to try to prove his intruder theory. It was a disgrace. It was a disgrace. That is the echo that people may be hearing today in some of these other cases. So why has not Billy Dunn and Sean Atkins been arrested in the disappearance and death of Haley Dunn? 109,000 deviant images were found, sexual perversion, lies, drugs, and violence, part of history. What part of a grand jury would not understand that? In the case of Baby Lisa, we had a police captain who was bravado and harsh-talking and standing in front of the microphone, and we will bring this case to a close, and we will get to them, and we, you know, and he knew who had done it. He knew that the child died at her mother's hands. Joe Tacopina showed up, and it was almost as if the air was sucked out of the lungs of the police captain. His shoulders shrank. His voice became much less confident. He actually got louder, a sign of a lack of confidence, and the case went cold. People fear that here in Maine, the Baby Ayla case, Baby Ayla Reynolds case, is undergoing something similar, where there has not been arrests in a case that is not of any mystery to anyone. The only mystery is where the body was dumped, and even that's not much of a mystery because most believe it's in the river, similar to the Baby Lisa case. But they wonder, as I wonder about some of these cases, is where is the prosecutor's courage to press forward a case that they know basically what happened? And if they need help, why not use the tool of the grand jury? Why not allow a grand jury who can hear evidence and ask questions do such?
Mm-hmm.
But even that, if a prosecutor wants to sabotage a case, which I believe Alex Hunter did, when a prosecutor wants to sabotage a case, he will make it of no effect to the grand jury. Then we have Mary Lacey. Mary Lacey, I think she never met a camera she didn't like. She got wind about John Mark Carr. And if listeners are not familiar with him, he was a pedophile teacher, working over in Thailand. And he had written a series of emails and letters about his love for JonBenet and very creepy stuff.
It was very creepy.
Yeah, he was called Captain High Pants, and that was
it was just ridiculous.
Glenn Beck tagged him Captain High Pants. It was funny because they took his belt from him, so he was hoisting his drawers up very high, and it caught, I guess, Glenn Beck's funny ball at the time, and Glenn Beck called him, look at Captain High Pants. Well, the nickname stuck. Mary Lacey brought Captain High Pants, extradited him from Thailand, which cost a taxpayer money, without checking to see if he was even in Boulder Christmas of 1996. A couple phone calls, collects, would have shown that he wasn't. Not only did she spend the money for the extradition and bring him over, but she went and held the most self-congratulatory, vile press conference, where she laid out a long table and sat at the table and went and praised each one after the other in her office for solving the JonBenet Ramsey case. It was her moment in the sun where she was able to go before the entire nation, and everybody watched it. We were all watching it. And she wanted to thank this person was wonderful, and that person was wonderful, and this person was their dogged determination. And they were just the biggest self-love, self-absorbed, narcissistic group of idiots under one camera. No one having checked that John Mark Carr, Captain High Pants, wasn't even in Boulder, Colorado, Christmas time, 1996. And they had to release him. And it was probably the worst egg on her face that she could ever imagine. So when she got wind that there was touch DNA of unknown origin found somewhere in the evidence of JonBenet, she went and, through much expense, publicized that the Ramseys were clear of the case. She publicly cleared them. When the unknown DNA, it didn't indict them, it didn't condemn them, it didn't clear them. It just means that there's some DNA that wasn't recognized there. It could be anyone from a worker at a store, a laundromat, any way that this could be transferred from one person to another. Someone could hand you an article of clothing, you hand it to someone else, they hand it to someone else, and it goes to someone else, and it still gets transferred over. It could be anywhere of a bazillion people. But because it didn't match John or Patsy Ramsey, Mary Lacey, in order to save face, went and publicly cleared them. And that itself was a joke. It meant nothing. Yet, because it was done, people then respond without understanding and saying, well, I don't know what you're talking about. The Ramseys were cleared by the district attorney's office. This is the same district attorney's office that had the narcissist party about Captain High Pants.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it really shows how far that office was in terms of being corrupted and how much they feared going up against someone like Lynn Wood and the Ramsey attorney team. They shook in their boots. And in doing so, instead of saying, even keeping things close to the vest, they went and attacked the police. And they did so with venom. They did so in a very malicious way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that so took the wind out of the sails of investigators that it convinced them, like in the case of Thomas, Steve Thomas, this is not what I want to do with the rest of my life. I think he went on to become a carpenter or something, but he just could not care.
He couldn't do it.
No.
No.
And it's so discouraging to...
And God bless him, you know, if that's... He recognized it, and that's good. I'm sure he's much happier.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I know he gave a few interviews, and they sued him, and that was pretty awful. So I did want to cover the 911 call, but I know that we're getting close out of time.
We're close out of time. We've got 10 minutes left. If anybody would like to call in with any comments or question about the case, again, the number is 646-478-0982. So we are down to the last 9 minutes here. So please call in.
Talk a little bit about the CNN interview, which was really quite revelatory. When the Ramseys had gone on, they wouldn't talk to the police, but they would talk to the media, and that was something they could do about controlling.
Mm-hmm.
And
that one of the first things they were asked was, why did you decide to talk to us now? And John said, well, we have been pretty isolated, totally isolated, for the last 5 days, but we've sensed from our friends that this tragedy has touched not just ourselves and our friends, but many people. And we know that there's many people who are praying for us that are grieving with us, and we want to thank them to let them know that we are healing and that we know in our hearts that JonBenet is safe and with God, and that the grieving that we all have to do is for ourselves and for our loss, but we want to thank those people that care about us. So when he was asked, why do you want to talk now? And he talked about the last 5 days being isolated. He actually went on to say, we're pretty isolated. Then he said, we're totally isolated. And then he went on to describe how many friends around him that he needed to be able to thank everyone. It was just too numerous to thank. So he wasn't isolated at all. And he called it a tragedy, which is interesting. And he called it a tragedy that touched his life. Now, if my little girl had been murdered, a short time later, I wouldn't say that my life has been touched, and I wouldn't call it a tragedy. I would be angry, and it would be a murder, a brutal murder, and I would be frightened for others, and he wasn't. In fact, one of the things he said, which was really bizarre, what would you say regarding a murder of your child and that you didn't know who did it? You would say, we've got to find out who did this. We've got to find him. This is just horrible. That's not what the Ramsey said, though. John, and this was interesting, Patsy said, we've been overwhelmed by the cards and the letters and the visits from people that we haven't seen for years. So she said, we've been overwhelmed by the cards, the letters, and the visits, and people we haven't seen for years. So this is people that said they were totally isolated have been overwhelmed with visits, so they haven't got even their story straight here. And then John said, but the other reason that we've come on, for our grief to resolve itself, we have to find out why this happened. He didn't want to know who did it. He wanted to know why. And then he said, well, we were fortunate from almost the moments that we found the note to be surrounded by friends, our minister, our family doctor, a personal friend of mine, who was also an attorney, by the way. So he went from being totally isolated to literally being surrounded with people like that. It's an attempt to persuade people for that they're grieving and everything else. At this point, they should be in shock and numb and angry to find out who did this. Well, for John, it wasn't about who did this. He said, it's not because we're angry, but because we have to go on. Now, wait a minute. Why aren't you angry?
Mm-hmm.
wow. It's just kind of a strange answers to give. So there were things in the initial days that we saw where they were not cooperative with police, where they did not make any of the expected statements that anyone else would say, shock, anger, fear, any of those things. Right from the 911 call, we hear something that was staged and rehearsed. The 911 call is staged and it is deceptive, and we'll cover that in the next program. Just as the ransom note was staged and rehearsed and written twice for the most part. It kind of sums up the case.
Oh, for sure.
But I lost you there, Kim.
I'm sorry. No, I had my mic muted and I'm talking to you and I can hear me. Anyway. There is so much going on in the chat room right now. Cobnob is asking, why has John stayed silent rather than, oops, it goes by so fast, rather than asking for help catching the killer?
I think any father would be demanding help and wanting help, but he hasn't. Yeah, he hasn't. And I don't think he wants the killer caught.
Also, do you see any relationship between the Ramsey case and the McCann case?
Yes, I do. In fact, there's a thread that goes between them, maybe that of having somewhat affluence and money to be able to hire lawyers, that sort of thing. But also, there were in both families, there was a very strong need to control information, particularly in the media. Both came across like slick and more interested in controlling information and being able to control the media, much like the Amanda Knox family, than interested in justice. Neither family showed interest in justice in terms of the Ramseys and McCanns. Both of them showed a need to control media. So I think that's a common thread.
Mm. What else did we want to cover tonight?
The changes I think people felt over time. Some people were honest about their emotions, and they said, when Lou Smith got involved, I really felt that he would be trustworthy and he would be honest, and so it was hard for me to picture that he really wasn't keeping an open mind. Anyone's religious belief, just within the norm of religious beliefs, may mean that they desire to be truthful, to be accurate, but it doesn't mean that we won't project our own feelings and we won't have sympathies get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the Charlie Rogers case where people mm-hmm. saw her cry on television and thousands of people donated money to her.
Yeah.
The emotions,
yeah.
These things. It doesn't mean everybody's an idiot or everyone's dishonest because they believed her. It means that we're all affected. And this is why we debrief with others, why we strive to keep an open mind, to allow the evidence to guide us and that sort of thing. It's difficult. And I think that Lou Smith probably was a really decent guy who had a really hard time with his own conscience rectifying certain things about that, yet he was hired to try to prove that an intruder did it. And people were angry that he had actually prayed with the Ramseys and that sort of thing and said, if that's where the evidence leads me, and he is as subject to human emotions as anyone else. The fact that he would be a man of prayer or belief doesn't change anything. Any of us would be subject to that type of difficult, struggling feelings. So he's no different.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to, I guess we should wrap it up here. We've got a minute left. Thank you, Peter, as always.
I think next program we should start with the 911 call.
I do too. The 911 call for sure. You're the best.
Thank you.
I want to say thanks to our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless. And stay safe. And God bless you, Peter. And thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to be here with you.
Thanks, Kim.
And don't forget, cocktails and hors d'oeuvres served in the chat room after the show.
Good
thank
night.
You. Good night.